Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is Chad the Hammer Riley.
Ooh, is that my name now?
I think that we can go with that right
now. You want
now.
Me to bring the hammer down?
Maybe not.
Come on, it was the Avengers.
It was close. It was close.
Fine.
But if there's any indication of what we're going to be talking about, that is it. We're going to be talking about the mighty Thor, so stick around. If they be worthy, the Filmlosophers are presented by Mingle Media TV and recorded live each week at VGB Studios. Like a trip along the Bifrost to any of the nine realms, you can access every episode of the Filmlosophers on Player FM, Audio Boom, Stitcher, Good Play, Google Play, iTunes, or Libsyn anytime. It's always a good play, all the time.
It's always a good play.
Once you're
Who
all caught
put
up,
that there?
Once you're all caught up, new episodes debut each Wednesday. The halls of Valhalla overflow with mead and conversation, but while you're stuck on Midgard, social media is a great place to have a conversation. Like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/filmlosophy101 to stay up to date on new film releases and other movie news. Last but not least, you can access all of our previous episodes at vgbstudios.com alongside other amazing podcasts like Video Game Bang and me, myself, and I. So like we said, we got a great show in store, and you know what? It's interesting because of the fact that this whole month, we've been kind of gearing up towards... Well, actually, the last couple of months, we've been gearing up towards, what's going to be coming out in November, which is obviously Thor Ragnarok.
So excited about this movie.
It really has pretty much been one of the most anticipated Marvel films of the year. So
it's definitely one of those franchises that sort of had started out as a Dark Horse franchise among, the Marvel Cinematic Universe. You've got the multi-franchise... universe. And Thor was not really one of the front-running properties, but all the stuff that we've seen in the trailers and the commercials and the set visit photography and video and everything, it really looks like this movie is going to dominate and win in a big way. Kind of come out of left field swinging, and it looks like it's going to surprise and delight.
It's true. In less than 2 weeks, the next entry into the MCU is set to release in theaters. Bringing together an amalgamation of two incredible Marvel storylines, the film Thor Ragnarok is well on its way to creating a unique and fun experience for fans and moviegoers alike. But to understand the point as to where this story picks up, you need to go back to the beginning and see where it all started. We're actually going to take a closer look today at the first two films of this story and catch you up on everything you need to know about Marvel's Thor. Now, we're going to talk a bit about both comic book version as well as Marvel Cinematic version, because as much as they sound like they're the same, storyline and it's the same thing, they really aren't. And the great thing about this show is that we actually have our own resident Marvel expert, which is awesome. And so he couldn't be here today, so we had Chad fill in.
I don't know about expert, but I know a few things in addition to whomever you have in mind.
Well, see, here's the thing. What you guys don't know is that Chad is insanely sold out for Marvel. He loves the brand, the franchise. He loves the stories behind it because of the fact that there's a whole deeper conversation to go into that, but
I grew up with them is the in a nutshell version.
In a nutshell.
I mean, they were from age 8, I think. Until really the present day.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm pretty familiar with most, at least the main characters. I don't know all the side characters. Squirrel Girl, not my thing. But somebody like Thor or Captain America or any of the X-Men, I'm good to go. Ask me a question, I'll tell you no lies.
And it's true because usually when these movies come around, one of the first things that I tend to do is I happen to dive into research. So I'll go head first into whatever... mythos or origin story there is about the property, So when I come into it, I'll be able to listen and kind of catch a lot of the key things that are going on in the film that maybe the most avid, you know, normal moviegoer doesn't really catch. You, on the other hand, have a lot of this knowledge literally just resting at the forefront of your brain. So when we go and see Marvel films, there are certain opportunities where you just like, oh yeah, did you catch that? And oh yeah, that's what happened there. After the movie, you're like, oh, did you catch that Easter egg here? I'm like, dude, I barely caught the fact that the black guy was Nick Fury. But it's like, we're
well, I do remember when we went with a whole big group of people to go see Avengers, the first Avengers film,
yeah.
And the teaser at the end with Thanos, at the end, almost everyone in the row, well, not almost, there were many people in the row who were not comic fans, not aficionados of Marvel, and they said, okay, so what was the deal with the purple guy with the weird chin? Who the heck is that? And they were expecting to wait until the internet could tell them, and, you know, thankfully, myself and a couple other folks in the group already knew the answer to their questions and could tell them more than they even need to know, really, to get them ready for, ultimately, many, many years later, what is going to be seen next summer during Avengers Infinity War.
And that's true, because we took the time in previous episodes in terms of Marvel films to really kind of highlight and focus on the fact that there's just information that, yes, you can know right offhand as a moviegoer, but there's really it's great to know that these films have something for even the most experienced Marvel fan to be able to catch on to certain things like that. Like, you're right, it took people like a couple of weeks after the fact, after the film debuted, to be like, wait, who was that guy? Oh my gosh, they're gonna fight Barney, and, you know, kind of things like that. And it got a little cloudy for a lot of people, because they're like, not everybody knew. But for people who truly had a deep, you know, affinity for the franchise and for the comics itself, they were able to pick up instantly and say, oh yeah, this is Thanos. This is, you know, and then know the whole depth as to, oh wait, so if he's going to be in it, then that means boom, 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 boom.
Well,
boom,
and I think that there's the hidden value. Again, this episode we're talking about the Thor franchise of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and we're going to get into it in a little bit, but Thor was one of the founders of the Avengers. He's been a mainstay in the Marvel Comics universe since its genesis, essentially. And yet, he was usually one of the lamest characters in the comics. And I apologize to longtime Thor fans that are like, well, but no, he's the most amazing. He's the god of thunder. He's based on Norse mythology. And okay, I get it. I do understand. In the right hands, he's a compelling character. His stories are interesting and have a unique flavor that many of the other characters don't give you.
Yeah.
But for many, many years, he was not one of the marquee. I mean, he was one of the spotlight characters because he was one of the Avengers founding members. And he just has a whole different dynamic than any other character, minus perhaps Hercules, who also shows up as an Avenger and has his own adventures aside from that, you know, from the Greek deity perspective. But Thor really was never one of the most beloved. He was never a Spider-Man. He was never really a Wolverine or a Deadpool level character in terms of really vibing with a large percentage of the Marvel Comics audience. And so to announce that, you know, when they're building the architecture of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, to announce that Thor was going to be one of the primary franchises, and in fact was going to be debuted before Captain America,
mm-hmm.
You know, the first one, it was an interesting decision because he's not that level of popularity. But I think that one of the magical things that they have done with the character, and very similar to what Robert Downey Jr. did with Iron Man, who has often been a marquee character for the comics, but
oh, yeah,
really was due for a renaissance by the time the movies came around, and Robert Downey Jr. alone provided that. The read that he gave of the character in the first Iron Man film absolutely shifted the tone of the writing and the artistic choices stylistically in the comics for the better, I think.
Oh yeah.
To bring a little more familiarity, not to make the comics version the same as the movie version of the character. Same with Thor. There have been changes that have been made to, you know, maybe play up the humor a little bit more than had been done before. I mean, Thor for years was written almost in a Shakespearean manner. Lots of these and thous and yees, and the whole groove and dynamic was very different, and for some people, a little obtuse and a little off-putting, minus the, you know, brawls, the fights, which are very easy to understand, you know, fisticuffs and monsters from other realms and all that kind of stuff. But ever since, you know, they really kind of hit a tone with the first Thor movie, which we're going to hop into and start talking about, you know, they made some stylistic choices to change and shift the way that they were handling the character in the comics. And today I would argue that the Thor properties are some of Marvel's best print / digital comics materials. I think that they're phenomenal and they're in great hands with a phenomenal writer, number one, who clearly loves the character and is also really, really good at writing. But that's a little bit of a diversion from the movie stuff that we're going to talk about in more detail. But I think it all really comes back to, you know, when they first announced Thor as one of their main marquee franchises, I think a lot of us familiar with the Marvel Comics universe kind of scratched our heads a little bit and said, really? Thor? I mean, kind of. Like, I get his stature, his prominence, but how are you going to translate that for a modern movie-going audience? Are there going to be a lot of these and thous and ye shalls and ye shalt nots and, you know, all the, you know, the odd sentence structure that you typically associate with a Shakespeare play, but without the musicality of Shakespeare and the poetry side of it? And I think that they made some wise choices. And now we're seeing that it's panning out into some really enticing ground, I guess, for setting the stage for Infinity War. Thor, really, I mean, obviously people are familiar now with Guardians of the Galaxy, but Thor was the introduction to the cosmic side of the Marvel Cinematic Universe in terms of introducing the different realms and the Bifrost that transport you between them and, you know, the different kinds of people that you find in the different realms. All of that came from Thor, and Guardians then has seized upon the opportunity to expand upon the cosmic elements, you know, quite dramatically and pretty darn well. But Thor was sort of the starting ground, and I think it's really special that Thor Ragnarok is going to be essentially the final of the tentpole franchise films before Infinity War hits in May. Now, you will have Black Panther in between now and then.
Yeah.
You know, but that's a brand new franchise, somewhat launching into a whole new phase of storytelling, and also probably somewhat connected to, you know, the inciting incident of Infinity War, whatever that ends up being. But Thor Ragnarok is really our last known outing into space, which is where Thanos comes from.
So, I know they're Marvel films are known to be really long, and so we're going to kind of really just break this down into a quick synopsis of both films, where you have the first film, Thor, simply titled Thor, which debuted in 2011, and in a nutshell, Thor Odinson is the Prince of Asgard. When his irresponsible behavior threatens his homeland, he's stripped of his power and banished by his father Odin to Earth. While exiled, Thor learns humility, finds love in Jane Foster, and helps save his new friends from a destructive threat sent by his jealous adopted brother, Loki. In the process, Thor redeems himself in the eyes of his father and is granted access to his power once more. So this was, as we said, debuted in 2011. Between this, you do have the Avengers film, which you had mentioned earlier.
Well, after... You had Thor, and then you had Captain America, and then you had the Avengers.
Yes.
The original.
But I mean, in terms of his presence and what he's doing in the midst between this one and the next film.
Oh, yeah. We're going to park here for a second, though, yeah. Right, and talk about his introduction.
Yeah. Because
It was honestly really, really well done. They had Kenneth Branagh in the director's chair. because he has a lot of clout in the Shakespearean performing side of the entertainment world. He's done a lot of the stage plays, made mm-hmm. several films based on Shakespeare. And as mentioned a few minutes ago, on paper, the Thor comics sound similar to a medieval, or not medieval, a Renaissance Elizabethan stage play sort of voice.
Yeah.
Again, it lacks the poetry and musicality of Shakespeare because nobody's Shakespeare but Shakespeare. But the overall cadence and sound of it,
mm-hmm.
you know, you think you're reading some derivative work of, you know, that guy that wrote Romeo and Juliet that you had to read in freshman year of high school. But so I think it was really brilliant because the first film, which he did not return for the second film as director, but Branagh brought really a very theatrical mindset to the voice, the pacing, the tension between the characters, particularly the brothers, Thor and Loki, who are two of the primary figures in Marvel, whether you're talking about on paper or on in film. And the set construction, the set design, the costuming, the way the music worked, all of it had a very, it felt somewhat derivative of the beats that you would find in a Shakespeare play in a good way, not derivative as in like you're being lazy, but like wisely he leaned into it, he and his crew. Which was really good because then by the time you got to some of the fighting, I mean, there's a little hokiness and a little campiness. I mean, the guy swings a hammer and starts flying. Like the hammer pulls him along through the sky. There's only so much you can do to make that cool. And I think they succeeded. But, you know, you've got to have some of those set pieces, costumes, and general tone that helps to sell what on the surface could be very, it could come off very bland.
Oh, yeah.
Sibling rivalry. The man throws a hammer into the air and it pulls him into the air along with it. And he's prideful and needs to learn humility.
Well, and even in talking about the first film, it could have easily been a cheesy type of Marvel film where sticking to the source material, as you've talked about and as I've seen, it could have easily come off as a very campy Marvel film. It could have easily been one of those films that people would have made true to the source material and Marvel would have been like, you know what? I think we'll pass.
Yeah, in the wrong hands, it totally could have been Marvel's first B movie.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't.
No.
But
no.
In the wrong hands, it could have been.
But I think one of the great things about this is that they do take that Renaissance style and they add a little bit of a almost like a steampunk aesthetic to it to give it a very Renaissance-ish looking feel, but while still being a little bit more technologically modern. Advanced.
Yeah, it's. I mean, definitely that it has this sort of, I don't want to say vintage aesthetic, but like it you know, they wear capes for crying out loud and helmets and
armor. And
yeah, I mean, it all looks very dated. However, there's the integration of technology because they are another race of beings in the cosmos who, you know, to the Norsemen of Earth of Midgard, you know, they looked like gods.
Mm-hmm.
Because of how different their abilities, their stature, their lifespan, their technology, all of it just was, you know, so that's kind of how the story goes. But
yeah,
I agree. There was definitely some attention that was paid to make it look very formal and regal and, you know, austere and powerful in an old school kind of way, but also show the technological side.
Yeah.
Because they are the most advanced race.
Oh, yeah. You know,
basically. Among the Nine Realms, they are the top.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I think that really comes across well in terms of...
Well, I guess technically Heaven is also a realm, so perhaps that would be above. But really in terms of the races you see interacting.
Yeah.
Asgard is like the place to be.
I think this film really conveys that well to where it's not so much as a, I mean, to the untrained eye, it's just not even something to notice. It's like, oh, cool, visuals, nice, cinematography. But to the people who know where the source material is from and what it looked like according to the comics and how they took that design and totally revamped it while still keeping true to the style, I guess, the pure nature of the style of the comics, it's promising to see that kind of thing, because then you realize, okay, so they took this story and they took the source material and they're making it into something that I can actually appreciate. I wonder what the story is going to look like. I wonder what the rest of the film is going to look like. And it's kind of like those first impression type opportunities you get where when you see a film and you're like, the first 10 seconds is a scene that's just, oh, perfect example, Nocturnal Animals. the first 5-10 seconds of that movie, boy, I knew I wasn't going to like the rest of that movie. And sure enough, the way that film played out, the first 10 to 15 seconds of that film gave a clear, you know, indication of the tone of the rest of the film.
First 10 to 15 seconds that led into the first minute and a half to 2 minutes of all the same that then, yeah. Which, Nocturnal Animals is not a Marvel
film.
But your point is well taken.
Yeah,
and I think that one of the things that they really, really needed to get right, that in some ways, I don't know that it was totally on everybody's radar. One of the things they really, really needed to get right in Thor was the character of Loki, because Loki is one of the absolute primary bad guys in the Marvel universe in terms of the comics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's the trickster and he takes different shapes and forms and he's constantly meddling in all the different realms for various reasons, always sort of a self-centered purpose. And I don't know, as someone who kind of, in a way, discredited the importance of Thor's storyline, not his prominence as a character, but like how important his storyline was to roll out among the first for the movies, Loki kind of slipped in under my radar, because on a good day, ask me, you know, who were some of the most important bad guys, and I would totally put Loki in the top probably 3 or 4. Not in terms of power sets, but in terms of repeat performances, repeat appearances. He shows up all the time and he's constantly, he does all kinds of different types of bad guy stuff. He's not a one note character, because of his tricksiness and his subterfuge and all of it. He's got a lot of variety and flavor, which is why a lot of the writers and artists and, you know, editors and whatnot, they all like to use him, because he's not ever pigeonholed, aside from his basic psychology. And so it kind of slid under my radar of, oh, I bet, you know, they searched long and hard to find the right performer for Loki. Like, it was just more of a, oh, well, if you've got Thor, then you're going to have Loki. Okay, let's see what they do with a movie Loki. And I had no idea when I saw Thor that Loki was the primary antagonist for the Avengers. Like, he was leading the bad guy crew that brings the Avengers of the movies together for the first time. And I didn't realize, seeing Thor, how important that role, like casting the right person, going to be.
Knowing full well down the road that this person not only was just going to be, not only was going to be the adopted brother and antagonist in this film, but play a larger role throughout the rest of the MCU.
Yeah, I mean, phase 2 and phase 3. The Red Skull, who was the big bad for
the first Captain America.
Captain America, the first Avenger, which was a year after Thor. Or later in the same... No, it was the year after. And he disappears at the end. He may or may not show up again, but the Red Skull is not a character that needs to constantly be there. He doesn't really change much. He's just always... I mean, he's a former Nazi scientist who's trying to take over all of creation. So, I mean, as big as his plans might be and grandiose, he's a one-hit one... Like, he's a one-note kind of character, almost always. But Loki easily could have been treated in the same manner in translating him to film. Thankfully, though, they found a very capable performer, unknown at the time, really. Tom Hiddleston, I mean, he kind of came out of nowhere, and this role has really defined his early career. And he has massive, massive legions of fans. as a performer, and the character does. I mean, you know, many of them are women, which is not a bad thing to note, because comics, movies in general, for many years have been kind of put in the, you know, like this is a dude movie kind of category, even though there are scores of women and girls who read comics and love them.
Yeah.
And have been fans for generations by this point. But just when you're generalizing and simplifying the equation, so to speak, people think, oh, well, this is a dude type movie, especially Thor. It's, you know, two brothers, their sibling rivalry, and they're both trying to get dad's affections, and one of them's trying to save the world, one of them's trying to destroy it, and, you know, whatever, and that's a dude thing. But, I mean, they really struck gold with Tom Hiddleston as a performer,
yeah,
because he's appealing to the women, but also he's really good at the role.
Oh, yeah. If anything, this is, like you said, this is the role that kind of defined the rest of his career, because I'm looking at his IMDb page, and a lot of what he's done prior to this is all TV appearance, TV show appearances, TV movie appearances, and one film titled Unrelated. But everything
I think he had just essentially graduated not too many years before. I mean, like, he finished whatever, college, university. Sorry, I'm like, I don't know what the Brits call it. University, he had finished university, what, 4 years before the, I mean, like, he just hadn't had a lot of time to develop a career yet before this ended up working out for him. And for him, I mean, it's essentially, it's akin to what Wolverine did for Hugh Jackman's career.
It's true. That's very true. And you're also right in the aspect of picking the right person to play the villain, because if you're looking at long-standing villains that are still relevant in the MCU, that even though not all of them have died or anything, because nobody, I mean, that's kind of the rule. Nobody ever truly dies in the Marvel property, period.
Or they do, but they can always come back.
People have flocked to Tom Hiddleston's performance as Loki as the key villain to constantly look out for. It's like everybody is enthralled with the fact of not only his performance, but just him as the character itself outside of the film, like the appearance he made at San Diego Comic-Con.
Oh, yeah.
As Loki, and the crowd went nuts.
They went super crazy.
So it's incredible to be able to see somebody who embodies the character so well that it transcends even just comic, just mere comic book fans, but even movie fandom, and even, you know, outside of that as well, just the allure of
people. And we'll get into it in a moment, but his popularity in the role significantly influenced the second film,
mm-hmm,
the Thor: The Dark World, because it was written one way, and like the shooting script, everything was one way, and then, you know, because they prep these things as far in advance as they can, because it's part of the overall larger architecture of the entire cinematic universe. But they had prepped it one way, and because of his popularity, not the character's popularity necessarily, but Tom Hiddleston's popularity as the character, they reworked some of the storyline in The Dark World to use him more than they had anticipated. And I think that's a huge credit to his acting chops within the role, and a huge credit to the powers that be over at Marvel Films for actually listening to their audience and not being afraid to make, you know, an intelligent change. You know, it makes pieces of The Dark World a little bit choppy. You can tell some of the bits where they were like, oh, we need to put Loki in here. You know, not that he wasn't in the story at all. He was.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But you can tell that there were some changes that were made somewhere in the midst of the pre-production/production/post-production process to get as much of him as they could.
It's
in
true.
The movie.
And in terms of that film, Thor: The Dark World, which came out in 2013, 2 years later after the first film, that synopsis in a quick nutshell is, after returning to Asgard after the events from the Avengers film, Thor helps the Asgardian armies restore peace in the Nine Realms. During these events, he's reunited with Jane Foster after she becomes host to the Aether and a target of the Dark Elves. Thor and his fellow warriors fight against the Dark Elves during the Second Dark Elf Conflict, killing their leader Malekith and ending the threat. Eventually, the Aether is removed from Jane's body and the Dark Elves are defeated. Thor then renounces his claim to the throne and leaves Asgard for Earth so he can stay with Jane. Which, ironically, is the last time you ever see Jane.
Yeah, I'm like, ironically, that didn't work out, apparently. It's interesting because... So, in the first film, you had, you know, the brother versus brother kind of conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you had the love story between Thor and Jane Foster after he is banished, really, to Midgard, to Earth, to prove that he's worthy to wield Mjolnir, or as Jane Foster's lab assistant intern friend likes to say, Mew Mew, because she doesn't know how to pronounce it. Which I think is very relatable for most of the rest of us. Mew Mew. So, you know, he's banished to Earth. You know, famously, for those of us who were already aware of some of the other characters in the comics, Hawkeye made his debut in a scene where Thor was trying to lift the hammer from where it had landed in, you know, what, Nevada or wherever it was. And
I think it was Arizona.
Shield had, you know, surrounded the whole thing, and he sneaks in and tries to rip it out, but he's not yet worthy to once again wield the hammer, and Hawkeye's up in the crow's nest getting ready to snipe him with a, you know, an arrow. And you know, so you had that character introduction in that film, and then obviously Hawkeye went in to the Avengers as well. And by the time you get to the Dark World, Loki has tried to take over the Earth, leading an army of aliens called the Chitauri. And basically as a herald, essentially, of Thanos. I mean, Thanos gives him the staff with what we find out later is an Infinity Stone inside to lead this army and take over the Earth. Loki fails. At the end of the Avengers, Thor takes Loki in chains back to Asgard. And that's essentially... With the Cosmic Cube. What's that?
With the Cosmic Cube.
Yes. And this is essentially where the Dark World picks up, because Loki is immediately brought before Odin in the throne room and sentenced to the dungeon. Odin, who, by the way, is portrayed spot on.
Oh, yeah.
By Sir Anthony Hopkins.
Mm-hmm.
Spot on. I mean, Odin in the comics, you'd think that, you know, the Allfather who made everything and whatever in Norse mythology, like he would be just this really impressive, imposing figure. But the way that he's written in the comics, I think the way that he is in many of the original mythological stories, but also the way that he's written in the comics and the way that he's portrayed in these movies, he's a little... all over the place from time to time. You know, like there's some fickleness to, there are nuances to his character. It's easily a character that you could be very superficial and very two-dimensional with because of his title, his role. But Anthony Hopkins really, I mean, he really brings some gruff and gristle and, you know, that inconsistency that Odin sometimes displays in leading his realm or leading his children, dealing with his wife.
And it's no surprise, too, with somebody of the caliber of, you know, Sir Anthony Hopkins in the role of a Marvel character, which obviously is also a Norse mythological character as well. But in terms of
that's
the
just
Marvel
our favorite word to stumble over this episode, the mythological. I promise we know how to say it and what it means.
We can speak good English. No, but to have somebody like that to be able to say, sure, I'll step into this Marvel ring and throw my hand in at this particular character who happens to be probably the most powerful character in all of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, as well as the Marvel comic universe, you know, they have yet to even tap into everything that this man can do. And yet you see Anthony Hopkins, and not only do you see like just the presence that he'll command when he needs to command it, because he can play, you know, to the back and he can play kind of a little bit less intimidating. But then when he wants to, he can command the entire set and just instantly stand about 10 feet higher than where he was. But simultaneously, he also does wisdom really well. He also he does the characters so well, you probably could say that this character has been like 50 years in the making just for him to play the role.
Well, and he's not... The thing that's so interesting about the character and his portrayal of the character in these films is he's very unapologetic.
No.
He's not the kind of leader who really depends upon being well-liked Mm-mm. by his people. He's not a tyrant, but he doesn't need affirmation from anybody.
No.
Least of all, his children.
Yeah.
I mean, he consistently puts them in their place all the time in both films. And obviously, by the time you get to Avengers and then the second film, The Dark World, Thor has proven himself worthy once again because he's learned to be humble and he has regained the use of his trusty hammer, Mjolnir. And, you know, so he's vanquishing, you know, alongside the Warriors Three and Lady Sif. He's vanquishing bad guys in the Nine Realms. And in the meantime, there is this event called the Convergence, which happens once every 5,000 years, where the Nine Realms essentially all line up in a row. And so the barriers between the realms are thinner. And in the past, when this had happened, Malekith, who is the leader of a race called the Dark Elves, they come from a realm of all darkness, and that realm predates much of the rest of the universe. So when light began to influence the darkness, their people were vanquished. And Malekith tried to, in one of the last convergences, Malekith had tried to use this thin barrier, thin membrane between the realms to take over all of them at the same time using a substance called the ether, which yes. you mentioned. And that's, we're led to then understand and believe that this is a form of an infinity stone, which in the mythology of the Marvel Comics and the MCU, they are basically the most powerful elements. Once you have all of them and the gauntlet, you can take over all of reality, and that's what Thanos is after. And presumably is going to be able to do for some time in Infinity War when it comes out. But the ether is the only one, Odin basically explains through storybook telling, storytelling with a book, that the ether is the only one that's fluid. All the rest of them are stones, and the ether is something other than a stone. It's more like a fluid gas that hovers over you and gets sucked inside of you and takes you over, and Malekith is trying to use it now, once again, to take over all nine realms, now that there's another convergence. And many of the members of Asgard don't even think the Dark Elves exist anymore. That's how long it's been since the last time they were fully vanquished.
Yeah.
But Malekith and some of his associates have been sleeping on a spaceship for millennia, and they're awoken by the fact that they have a new opportunity. So it's very interesting because Thor as a property can already be a little bit obtuse, as mentioned before, but also in terms of the architecture of the MCU, they've used these Thor movies to really basically try to provide a history lesson.
Oh yeah.
Of the underlying fabric of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So in addition to the characters potentially flopping, which I don't think they have, but there was the potential for failure with this property. So with the potential for the characters to not really read well, the storyline did not go very well, and just overall confusion about why was this one of their primary franchises, now it really makes a lot of sense in retrospect because the Thor films have had a lot of the history that people need to know to start to understand what's about to happen next year with Infinity War,
yeah.
in terms of, you know, these stones and what, I mean, there, all of it has been largely explained in Thor, some also in Guardians of the Galaxy, and a smattering here and there have been mentioned in other films, but I mean, Thor is basically the history book of the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Well, and Guardians of the Galaxy came out the year after, when you actually have the collector giving that little
after the Dark World.
After the Dark World.
Yeah.
So essentially, Thor: The Dark World, as Chad mentioned, gives us the preliminary history of the Infinity Stones, which is pretty much the first indicator of, like you said, what was to come, which is next year's Infinity War mm-hmm. film. And it is true that this film, the second film, did have a little bit of an issue taking off at certain parts and landing and taking mm-hmm. off and landing. But overall, it still does continue the story of Thor. And actually, on a bigger scale, like you said, it really does give more of that backdrop of the cosmic aspect of the MCU. Because the only glimpse we've had into that was after the fact with Guardians 1 and 2. But prior to that, this part of the Marvel comic universe hadn't been explored. In fact, it hadn't even been talked about.
Right.
Aside from, you know, aliens coming this way and there's another big purple alien that's supposed to be coming and whatnot. There's no talk about what the whole purpose is around that whole thing. So Thor: The Dark World really does give itself a little bit of a pat on the back when it talks about that aspect of the film. But it does lead us into kind of breaking down a couple of little important things about the franchise itself in terms of the similarity or the difference to the comic book origin, because as we said, there is a comic book origin that dates far back before the first film ever debuted for the Marvel absolutely. Cinematic Universe.
Well, especially because they borrow from Norse mythology. So, mm-hmm. I mean, the character of Thor, if you will, has existed in real world, real time, has existed for hundreds of years.
So I don't know if you want to give a little bit of the history in terms of the Thor comic book.
Yeah, I mean, basically, the powers that be at the time with Marvel Comics were wanting to continually introduce characters. There was a big shift, actually, following like World War II, some superhero comics had existed around the, you know, world pre-World War II and into World War II. But after that, the whole industry kind of shifted into more pulp fiction kind of stuff with, you know, tales of romance or, mm-hmm. you know, suspenseful tales and like creepy things. And just the tone of them was very different. And so in the early 60s, you have some creators, Stan Lee, Jack Kirby, and several others, trying to basically reignite the superhero thread. There were some properties that kind of were here and there, you know, from the mid-40s into the early 60s, but they weren't particularly huge titles. And then in the early 60s, you've got, the Avengers coming together.
Yeah.
You have Spider-Man appearing for the first time, Journey into Mystery. Thor debuted in Journey into Mystery, which was kind of an anthological title. They introduced new characters and new stories continually through that. It was kind of just a series of one-offs, if you will. And then as they found things sticking, they would bring them back and sometimes give them their own titles. You also have the Fantastic Four coming into being at this time, the X-Men, the first version of the X-Men, Hulk, obviously, with his gamma bomb. And so all the characters that we now know pretty well because they've had 75-ish years of history.
True.
In the pages of the comics, at the time, they were new, and nobody knew which ones were going to be more popular than others. As I mentioned before, they also have a version of Hercules, which I would say to many people, who have had a westernized upbringing in terms of education, you probably are more familiar with Greek mythology and Roman mythology than you are with Norse mythology. I think part of that is because it's a bit easier to explain.
Yeah.
And it's a bit older. And there are more things to talk about in terms of art and architecture and the influence of those people groups on the development of Western culture over the millennia. But so you're more familiar with a Hercules than you are with a Thor. But they're both mainstays of the Marvel Comics
True.
Universe and have been for many, many years. So, Thor, as mentioned, was a founding member of the Avengers, had his own kind of side story, adventures and misadventures. There's just a lot of opportunity to not do interesting things. I hate to say it that way, but there's a lot of opportunity to fail with this character.
Yeah.
He's oftentimes not the brightest bulb in the light set. He's not the sharpest tool in the shed. Under, you know, certain creators' hands. But over time, you know, he has matured quite well. As I said at the beginning of the show, I think the current writer, Jason Aaron, is sheer genius what he's done with this character for the last decade or so. The stories that he's telling, the huge cosmic eternal canvas that he's working with. I mean, he's really maximizing what this property can do. And I think we've seen a lot of that impetus in the movies, because a lot of times, okay, story of the week, Thor is a Norse god from Asgard, and he's stopping someone from another realm from doing something bad. You know, bad guy of the week kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Fairly trivial. Unless it's Loki. And
typical serial type.
Loki's just really interesting. And you've got some other characters. Hela, who's the goddess of death, who is actually also in the comics and in Norse mythology, Loki's daughter. I don't know that Cate Blanchett is going to be calling Tom Hiddleston daddy in the movie when it drops on the 3rd.
I don't think it's that type of film.
I don't think that they're going to really emphasize that aspect of the larger story from the source material. But you do have a lot of colorful characters in Thor's quadrant of the universe. But I think the thing that the movies have done really, really well, and we've really seen take off in the comics, is the huge canvas. Because these characters literally live for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And their point of view, their perspective, with knowing all the realms and being able to travel through all the realms and, you know, all of that, like, just their understanding of the framework within which every other character lives is so much broader than, you know, the heroes of Earth or even some of the aliens in the, you know, the Midgard realm, if you will. And to capitalize on that is a really smart choice, because Thor does, in the films, come off as a bit of a frat boy.
True.
With a good heart and a heroic spirit, but he's a bit of a frat boy. And,
which is well indicated in the first film.
And yet, he has this enormous breadth and depth of knowledge that, you know, when he gets mad, for example, when he gets mad at Tony Stark in Age of Ultron, the second Avengers movie, for creating Ultron without understanding what he was playing with. And, you know, Tony's laughing and he's like, I shouldn't be laughing right now, right? This is a bad thing, isn't it? Is it? Is it such a bad thing to try to save the world? You know, obviously Thor is very large, brawny, you know, he's the muscle. However, he's also really arguing, and he goes on a whole quest of his own in that movie. He's arguing about something that's at a level that even a genius like Tony Stark can't see. He hasn't been brought up in the same context as a person from Asgard, especially someone who's supposed to inherit the throne someday from Odin.
Yeah.
You know, once Odin kind of goes into his permanent, what they call the Odin sleep. And so even though he's not a genius like Tony Stark is a genius or Bruce Banner, the Hulk, his knowledge base is invaluable compared to the rest of them. He just knows so much more because of where he's from, essentially. And that's why I think it's been really smart for them to not only tell engaging stories with these films, and yeah, they've had some serious missteps along the way. For example, as much as I love comic relief, and Kat Dennings is really funny, showing so much of her in these films, being goofy and weird, it's kind of a distraction that's not always necessary. So yeah, there have been some elements that haven't really worked as well as they could have but using it as an action adventure film property that also can educate you about the entire framework of this cinematic universe, I think has been really intelligent for Kevin Feige and all the other people putting together the MCU.
Well, and it's interesting because of the fact that, like you were saying, this property has suffered from just so much mediocrity, if you will, in terms of story development that could have actually produced actual unique stories far beyond just the realm of, oh, you know, we are in a Renaissance-like utopia and everybody knows vast amounts of knowledge and we are all essentially gods and with one swing of our hammer we can destroy every opponent. That tends to get old really fast, and as right. you've put, and so being able to take from mediocrity, and I use the term loosely. I don't, if you're a longtime fan of the comic book character and you've, you know, enjoyed throughout the years what he's done.
That's... any property is going to have spans of mediocrity. Mm-hmm. When you've got properties that have been in print for this long, you're going to have whole swaths of years that comparatively are the mediocre years. You know, not that they didn't work for that audience for that time, but there were better stories that were told before and after.
Yep.
Thor just has more of those. Unfortunately.
But it's good to see that taking something like that, taking a property like that, and being able to kind of breathe life into it, and not only just breathe life into the cinematic aspect, but also kind of reinvigorating the character to where it should be in the most recent of comics. I mean, like you were saying, the most recent runs of Thor in the comics have been great, and the direction they've been taking that story has been awesome. Other previous iterations of the character in other media, you have obviously his animated appearances. He's been in just about every Marvel cartoon you can think of. All the way back to the 60s with the Marvel superheroes. He had a stint in the X-Men cartoon, the Silver Surfer cartoon, the Spider-Man and Friends mm-hmm. cartoon in the 80s. He actually even did a 1980s TV movie with the Incredible Hulk, the one
yes,
that was on.
Yes, he did.
And, which,
yes, he did.
It's funny that you mentioned the whole frat boy aspect, because ultimately Thor becomes like a surfer type guy at the end of that movie. Mm. And it's really interesting, but...
Well, there's a whole... You asked a few minutes ago about Thor's origins, if you will, in the comics and how it's different. They made some smart choices with what they do and don't tell you in the movies because there are some deviations that just wouldn't translate very well. So unlike, for example... To borrow from DC Comics, you've got Clark Kent and Superman. They're the same person, but they operate differently. But they are the same person. Clark Kent is a persona.
Yes.
Versus also in DC, the character of Shazam, which allegedly we may see at some point in film. Shazam, by day, is a 12-year-old boy. And when he says the word Shazam, he becomes basically like a Superman-type character. And they are different personas. They're not. It's not like, oh, I went and changed my clothes. There are two different aspects to the character. Similarly, for a long stretch of the run, Thor was two characters. One of them was a human named Donald Blake, who was a doctor, and who is referenced in
the first film.
Thor ends up wearing his name tag,
which happens to be
having his wallet or something. I can't remember exactly his ID. How it is. He has his ID in the comics. Donald Blake would, I believe, he carried a stick, and whenever he slammed the stick against the ground, he turned into Thor to solve a problem. But then when Thor was done solving the problem, Mjolnir turned back into a stick and Thor turned back into Donald Blake. So they were similar to the Shazam dynamic. They were two different aspects of the character. It wasn't just a costume change like it is with Clark Kent to Superman and back again. It was this really odd psychology. And it's happened more than once. Donald Blake has reappeared, even in some of the better runs of the more recent, you know, issues and whatnot. And by recent, I mean within the last, I don't know, decade or so, 10 to 12 years. Donald Blake appeared again. And so Donald is a human, and he's aware that Thor is his alter ego. And Thor is an Asgardian and is aware that the human Donald Blake is his alter ego, but they are not the same person. They convert back and forth, similar to like a Jekyll and Hyde, without the maliciousness. They're both good guys.
Yeah.
So wisely, the MCU architect said, nope, we're not going to go into all that. Like, it's too much weight. It's too much. We already have so much we want to accomplish with this property, and it's not an Iron Man or a Captain America property. So we're fighting the current already. So to weigh it down with all this unnecessariness is just not going to work.
Yeah. And it's funny that you say that, because yes, the Easter egg was in the first film, but to choose to go this route, like you said, was a much more smarter direction and overall just character development, you know, strategy, because yeah, that would have added too much headache to an already
well crazy. And honestly, and we can talk about this more next week, depending on, you know, to what degree we want to go into it after you know, because next week we're planning to review Thor Ragnarok.
Mm-hmm.
And in the comics currently, Thor Odinson is not the mighty Thor.
No.
He is not wielding Mjolnir. There's a female, and hopefully you know this by now if you care, because it's been revealed for, I don't know, 3 or 4 years by now.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Jane Foster is Thor currently.
Jane Foster is actually suffering from cancer at the time, and so, yeah.
But similar to what I was just mentioning with Donald Blake versus Thor, Jane Foster and Thor, there's a little more synthesis between the personalities, but they are different personalities. Foster is Jane Foster, and the Mighty Thor, even the female Mighty Thor, is a more bombastic, sort of prideful, confident, cocky persona that is not entirely Jane Foster. Like, Jane Foster, they're aware of each other and they influence each other, but it's one or the other. So again, in the comics, things are a bit more complex. And under the right guidance with the right, you know, person or people at the helm, it totally works. It's not hard to understand, but it is one of those things that would be really difficult to convincingly translate into film.
True.
It would overcomplicate it. And so they've kind of done away with that.
Especially seeing as how, I don't know if Natalie Portman has agreed upon returning to the franchise or to a Marvel film. So, I mean,
yeah, who knows?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, at least a cameo would be nice. Like, put her on TV. Like, she's being interviewed on television or something. I don't know.
So there's a vast history here with the character and within the Marvel comic universe, in terms of Thor and the entire property, I guess, if you will, with Loki, Jane Foster, Odin, a lot of this. So with next week's film coming out, and we're obviously going to be able to get a chance to see that, and you know, Chad has not stopped going nuts about it. He's so excited.
I'm basically already sitting in the seat.
He is. Are there any hopes or expectations that you have? I know I have a few, but at least two. Do you have any, maybe one or two hopes or expectations to see in the new Ragnarok film?
Sure. I think that, number one, I think it's brilliant that they are blending in aspects of a storyline called World War Hulk. Planet Hulk. World War Hulk came later. A storyline called Planet Hulk, where basically a lot of the other heroes got together and said, Hulk, you just rampage and you damage things and you can't control it, so we're banishing you, we're exiling you into space, goodbye. Mm-hmm. And they blast him off into space, and he lands on a prison world, and is transformed, like he's made to fight for his life. He's a gladiator in the arena, and then he becomes the victor, and then he takes over the planet. Yep. And I mean, it's a huge storyline. It's not all that old either. I mean, within the last 13 years or so, probably. Oh, yeah. Huge storyline.
Great storyline.
Totally revolutionized on paper what you can do with the character of the Hulk. So I'm really excited that they're blending some of that into this movie, and it already looks delightful in the trailers.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that I think is really, really key, and I love that they've done this, and I think it has a lot to do with the guy they've got in the director's chair this time around, because three films, three directors, right, for the Thor franchise. This time we've got Taika Waititi.
Yes.
New Zealander who has...
And I trust your pronunciation on that.
...sense of humor and really, really smart choices at balancing drama and levity in telling a story. And so all the bright colors and the new like the cutting Thor's hair and having him really embrace more of the humor that Chris Hemsworth as a performer is capable of bringing,
as we've seen,
to the role. I'm really excited to see kind of the... I think Thor is always going to be one of the more serious properties,
mm-hmm.
Because of essentially the power set and the perspective that an Asgardian has. I mean, for many, many years, Thor was essentially the Superman-level character of the Marvel Universe in the comics. Then they, you know, they made others. But mm-hmm. Thor was really the powerful, godlike, unstoppable hero with a heart of gold. But so in the films, I think, like, he still has that power set by and large, even without his hammer. We see in the trailer, Hela destroys it somehow.
Yeah.
And so he has other weapons, but he's still extremely strong. He's still the God of Thunder. He's, you know, he's capable, and, you know, he may be down, but he's not out. But I love that they're blending in some of the humor, because I think it is going to help to build into Infinity War without being overly serious. Infinity War is bound to be very serious.
Oh yeah.
Because of what's at stake. So Ragnarok, even though in mythology, Ragnarok is the fall of Asgard. I mean, it's the destruction of that realm and everything, really. And often leads then to a cycle of rebirth where the Norse gods, the Asgardians, if you will, are reborn. And sometimes they remember or forget specific things about their past. And this has happened in the comics a few times.
Okay.
So Thor comes back to life, but he doesn't remember his entire history with the Avengers, or he doesn't remember Jane Foster, or he doesn't really remember that he was ever worthy of the hammer, you know, like just different things. You know, Loki's reborn, Odin's reborn, all this, you know, it's happened. It's a cycle that happens. That was a total diversion from your question, though. So
no.
I'm glad, though, that because when they first announced the title, I guess what I'm getting at, when they first said the third Thor film is Ragnarok, and many of us went wild because it's like, oh, you're going that far? Like, you're destroying Asgard and all of the gods. That's incredible. But then to see the flavor of what has been developed and produced beyond that, I mean, they've changed the way the logo looks. They've changed the entire vibe of what that film title should feel like. I'm really excited to see, you know, tonally what they're going to pull off with this movie. I think it's going to be a whole lot of fun.
It's true. Any elements, like, because for me, I'm familiar with, I've read Planet Hulk and I've read World War Hulk. And so the idea, you know, the gladiator, you know, type hierarchy within the planet of Sakaar and whatnot, it's a great storyline. One of the key elements, though, that I'm hoping to see, I'm hoping to see a little bit more of the cosmic side characters that we don't normally get a chance to see within the regular, you know, Marvel films, because of the fact that it's all been earthbound, so to speak. So you have a lot of people who are from Earth The characters that you'll see are more than likely people.
What, you didn't like the Howard the Duck cameo in Guardians?
then you have Guardians, and that's a unique.
Or Cosmo, Russian cosmonaut dog that's psychic.
Yes.
Although we haven't seen him being psychic in the movies, but he is in the comics.
The Adam Warlock, you know,
the cocoon
chamber, cocoon chamber. But like in this aspect, because of the storyline, what it all entails, it'd be really great to see like maybe a glimpse of Beta Ray Bill.
Beta Ray Bill needs to find his way into that arena somehow.
He really does, because Beta Ray Bill has been a part of the comic universe since the mid-80s. Mm-hmm. And his, just what he brings to the character alone is great, and I'd love to see this actually fleshed out on screen so that we can see maybe him trying to help out with the breakout from the Gladiator Stadium or whatever, things like that.
Yeah.
That'd be super cool. Also, kind of digging into the idea of if Hela is going to play a role in the upcoming Infinity War.
Oh, for sure.
In the dynamic that I'm hoping it's going to be with Thanos and the whole allure that he has with his mistress Death, mm-hmm. and whatnot. And so hoping to see kind of the connecting links in the film throughout would be really great.
You know, there's no reason not to do it, I think. At this point, there's just no reason to avoid those little Easter eggs and those connections. I mean, to your point about Hela, the goddess of death, to tie her very concretely to Thanos is sheer brilliance. There's no reason for them not to do it, because in the comics, she's the Norse goddess of death, and she reigns over the realm of Hell with one L. And Thanos wants to court the actual like embodiment of the state of being that is known as death.
Yeah.
And they're different characters, but I think for the movie universe, there's no reason to not make some like at least cooperative aim, if not like an attraction between them. That stems in part from whatever it is that she's going to do in Ragnarok.
And it's so great. I'm really hoping, because of that last line in Avengers when his herald, if you will, goes, you know, to challenge the Earthlings, mm-hmm. is to court death. And it just, that line alone just makes you think, oh my gosh, are they going to go in that route? And then you find out, oh my gosh, Hela is actually going to be in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Are they going to? So, like,
yeah,
you said,
well, but in the comics, they are different. Hela are different figures. And so Thanos is enamored with death. Not with Hela.
No.
However, very recently, like within the last 2 or 3 weeks, there were some promo pages from a storyline that's going to be released essentially as a lead up to Infinity War in the comics universe, but it's happening in the months prior to when the movie releases, and Thanos and Hela are an item in those preview pages. Like, they are clearly together. So, and they look like their movie counterparts.
There you go.
So, wink, wink.
Yeah.
I think it's fairly safe to assume that there's going to be some sort of a I don't know if you'd call it a love connection in this case, but there's going to be a connection.
This is so awesome.
So you bring in a performer like Cate Blanchett.
Oh my gosh, you don't just have her
first,
for one film.
The first female villain in the MCU, like prominent. I mean, you've had like a couple bad characters who were females, but first prominent female villain.
Yeah.
She's not a one-hit wonder. You don't bring her in for one movie and then drop her like a bad habit, especially when she's playing the goddess of death, who basically can't die. She herself rules over the realm of the dead, so she can't die. They just try to imprison her in that place.
Yeah.
And not let her out.
And like we were saying, you cannot just put her in one shot in the entire Marvel Cinematic Universe and be like, all right, thanks, Cate. You did great.
Yeah. And I mean, also, sorry, I'm fanboying
now. Knock yourself out.
You've got Fenris the Wolf.
Oh, yeah.
Hulk versus Fenris. You've got Surtur, basically the devil. I mean, basically. Surtur is Odin's primary nemesis, usually in the comics. Like,
mm.
Odin and Surtur are usually the ones going at it, and Thor will occasionally step in to help. We've seen for months now in the trailer that not only does Thor apparently try to take him on and fail, but at some point the Hulk is taking him on.
That
which
looks
I
cool.
don't believe has ever happened in the comics. Some people might be able to correct me if it has, but I don't think we've ever seen that in the pages of the books.
Hmm.
So there's undoubtedly the flight of the Valkyries. Hello. They're on their Pegasi. And whether it's a flashback or the present day, I don't care. We're going to see a beautiful rendering of a battle between the goddess of death and the Valkyries.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing already. So there's obviously a lot about the storyline and the flow of this film and what's going to happen that we haven't seen. And I'm really, really glad that we haven't had too much spoiled ahead of time.
Oh, no doubt. And obviously we're excited. So let us know if you're excited about the film, if there's any little key attributes or parts of the storyline that you'd like to see fleshed out in the movie, or if you have your own little sneak peek information or whatever. Don't spoil it for us, but, you know, a little hint here or there wouldn't be bad. But let us know what you think on our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmlosophers. Before we go, we're going to leave you with a little bit of Halloween movie news. And in that, we're going to give you real quick our top five Halloween movies you need to see before the 31st. As a quick
time is ticking
compilation of the top five that we feel kind of embody the season as best as it can. So we're just going to run these down real quick. In our honorable mention, we got The Nightmare Before Christmas and It's the Great Pumpkin, Charlie Brown. Both great classics, great films to see with your family or friends. All around just
which
awesome films.
I totally advocated for them not to be honorable mentions because they're really the only Halloween movies that I can tolerate because I'm not a horror genre fan, but I accept.
But I am a horror genre fan, and the list goes on.
Yep.
Number five, we have Psycho, the original, not the one, not the remake. Number four, The Thing, starring Kurt Russell. Number three, The Descent. I say The Descent, but it needs to be the unrated cut because the unrated cut actually has an additional minute at the end that actually changes the whole focus of the film. As odd as it sounds, 1 minute makes that big of a difference in this movie. For number two, we got the self-titled Halloween movies with the Michael Myers and everyone else, Jamie Lee Curtis. Great films. Number one is a unique film called Trick or Treat. I forget who the director is, but it's almost like an anthological film that takes place on Halloween night.
Whoa.
And it's a very cool film. If you haven't had a chance to see it, you should check it out. It came out in 2007 with director Michael Dougherty. So it's a great film. It's awesome for Halloween. If you're looking for a great Halloween flick, that's your movie.
Honestly, I just let you run with this because it's not my cup of tea. Also, this Trick-or Treat, I've never heard of it.
It's a really awesome movie.
I saw
movie.
That you put this at number one. I'm like, why would you choose a movie that nobody knows?
Everybody who loves horror movies, is one of those movies that really, it slid under the radar, and you know what? It is a fantastic movie. If you like I said, anthological type movies where it has several pieces and it all kind of comes together, kind of like Crash.
I was just going to say like Crash.
Oh yeah, it's a great movie. I'll show it to you.
I'll pass.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Also, a little bit of upcoming weekend releases. You got Jigsaw coming out this Friday, Suburbicon starring Matt Damon and Julianne Moore, and Thank You for Your Service. That about wraps up another awesome episode of the Film Philosophers. Again, if you want to check out any of our other previous episodes, go to vgbstudios.com and you can check out all of our great episodes as well as other podcasts. This was an awesome show, and I'm much more excited about next week's movie. I was already excited, but this is really getting me amped
up.
It's
going to happen.
So, yeah, we'll let you know as soon as we see that movie, and we plan to come in here guns blazing. Maybe no spoilers, maybe. We'll see.
No, we'll totally spoil. we'll totally spoil.
So that about wraps it up. So from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
Class dismissed.